Hello, my name is Dr. Jim Doty, and I'm the host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast, where we explore the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. Hi, this is Dr. Jim Doty, host of the Into the Magic Shop podcast. My guest today is Dr. Paul Gilbert, clinical psychologist, who was awarded the Order of the British Empire. He's also the founder of Compassion Focused Therapy and Compassionate Mind Training. Paul is the author of 21 books and has published over 100 academic articles. Today, we're going to discuss a little bit about his backstory and how that influenced his decision to become a clinical psychologist, and also the fact that while he's a guitarist, he's not that good of one, which he admits. So he's not to be confused with the famous guitarist, Paul Gilbert. I hope you enjoy our conversation today, and thank you so much for listening. Well, Paul, it's great to have you. Unfortunately, as you know, we had to change platforms for technical reasons, but it's good to see you again. Well, I won't bore you again with a comment about your guitar skills. So just mentioning that will lead a number of people to search out your history with the guitar, or your mediocre playing of guitar, and also the reality that there is quite a famous guitarist by the name of Paul Gilbert also. Not to be confused with this Paul Gilbert. So a little bit earlier, we were discussing the fact that you grew up in Gambia, and you were sharing a little bit of that story. And as I always like to do, I'm always interested in people's backstory, which led them to their present, because obviously people's backstory are often the drivers of who they become. So maybe you can share the story about growing up in Gambia.
Yeah, so the backstory is that my father was a Spitfire mechanic during the war, and he was traumatized in lots of ways. You know, when airfields were shut up, and also, you know, if planes didn't come back, you would wonder, did anything happen mechanically? So he had a lot of stuff, and he decided to take off to Africa. He didn't really want to stay in England after the war, and so he went to Gambia as a mechanic, and then went to Nigeria, and we stayed there for quite a while. And then when I was about 11 or 12, just at the time of the Biafran War in Nigeria, I was sent back to boarding school. And so I was there until I was 17. And it was it was quite a harsh place in lots of ways, because it had a very free childhood, really roaming around. I didn't go to school very much. And I actually went to an American missionary school for some of the time, actually. And when I came to England, I had a very strong Texan accent. You know, I'd say things, I believe in God, I believe in the Bible. So that didn't fit in so well to an English boarding school, but there we are. So so that was that. And but I was lucky, because the group that I was with my year were a very affiliative year, and we got on very, very well. The year above us were not so much. They got into fights a lot. So I learned the importance of belonging, particularly when you were away from your family, because they were in Africa, I was in the UK. And so that became quite a thing for me. And it was quite an entrapping experience, because I'd gone from this very free and open, where I could just roam around and do what I wanted to do, basically, to being very regimented. So, you know, you had to go to bed at 7:30. You had to be asleep. If you talked out after lights out, you got caned. I used to get caned for all kinds of stuff. Nowadays, they'd be in court for abuse, I think. But in those days, they could do what they wanted. So that was... So I spent the rest of my life, my career, studying entrapment and depression, and did quite a lot of research on that. So, yeah, there are various things. And I actually had a depression in my early 20s, which were probably a reflection of that, which I wrote about in a book I did called Overcoming Depression. And I mentioned I had a depression then. And that was interesting, because I was always interested in brain states, and I knew something had happened in my head, you know, because I was getting all these strange feelings. I was getting these panics. I used to have cold baths to try and calm down. It was very bizarre, but I knew it was in my head. I knew it wasn't me somehow, you know. So all of those sort of experiences really set me on course for my research into mood disorders and working out how do you change these brain states, because as you know, I'm basically a brain state theorist. And from there, got very interested in compassion, because compassion has such powerful effects on the brain, right? If you can get people to kind of focus on compassion. So that's my backstory in brief, really.
Let me ask you a question, though. You mentioned your father and that he was traumatized by his experience. Did he, or did you sense, or maybe later reflect, that he himself was suffering from PTSD or the issues of what he went through during the war?
Oh, yeah, it was very bad. I had terrible PTSD. And of course, in those days, in the 50s, it wasn't really recognized. I remember once he got malaria and he had lots of hallucinations. I was about 8 years old. We were in Africa. We were in the middle of nowhere because we were in a... He was building roads, right? And so we didn't have any electricity or anything like that. We just lived in a mud hut, really. Drove my mother mad. And he was reliving a lot of stuff. So, you know, one of the experiences was when he was in Malta, the airfields were bombed, and him and his friend had actually shot. So they were in hospital, and the hospital collapsed, and his friend unfortunately died in that collapse, and they took 3 days to get him out. So he was very traumatized. And of course, you know what happens with males who are traumatized, they can also become a little aggressive at times. So that was a bit tricky. And he was always deeply, deeply regretful. But war is a traumatized, it's a horror, really. It's a traumatizing thing for the people that go through it. And God knows what's going to happen in Gaza and other places and so on. But it's a terrible thing, really.
Now, did you think that your own depression had sort of roots in the experience of growing up in that environment, or your own background going from this sort of carefree existence to, I would imagine, if my knowledge of English boarding school in those periods, it was not a pleasant place, and no, there was sort of indiscriminate punishment, and it wasn't a fair system by any stretch of the imagination.
That's absolutely right. It was a pretty harsh. It was pretty harsh, and that's why the relationships we had with each other was so important. And I was always a bit of a rebel. I've always been a bit of a rebel. I'm not terribly good with authority.
Paul, I've never noticed that. I'm shocked.
So I was always getting into trouble for smoking and all that sort of stuff. But yes, and as you know, I've always been terribly interested in towing the line particularly, but so all of that I think was very formative for me, but on the other hand, I'm also quite submissive in some ways, so
I think this is sort of this interesting contrast when you examine people or really get into who they are. There are a lot of contrasts and even contradictions to who we are, and that's an interesting segue, you know, this idea of our shadow self. And maybe you can just give us your insights or thoughts on that. My own experience, personal experience is, you know, when you try to push that away, this part of you you don't like about yourself, it always comes back to bite you. So you have to accept it and integrate it into who you are, and understand that that's just who you are without being afraid of it or ashamed of it. And it allows you, I think, to live with it much easier.
Yeah. I mean, that's such an important point. I mean, you know, we argue very much that, as do you, Jim, that, you know, we are biological creatures. We've been built by DNA. We'd be built for one thing only, or two things only, to survive and reproduce. And so our heads are full of the motivations and emotions that will guide most species to do that, which means, you know, competition, fighting, aggression, all that sort of stuff. That is part of being a biologically created being that's here for a short period of time and so forth. And one of the problems you've got with that is that then you can be struggling with these archetypal motives and desires and emotions, which seem to sometimes come out of nowhere. And you think, well, And the key, I think, where the Buddha's position is very important is not to over-identify as this is something about me, as opposed to this is something about how my biology has been programmed by nature. And so the ability, you know, mindfulness allows you to start to pay attention to the dark side without blaming that part of you. But it's, you say it's important to understand it. Otherwise, you start fighting with your own mind. You become ashamed of your own mind. You become frightened of the power of some of your darker emotions. And or you just act them out, which is, and then you harm other people. So it's a really important point. And you and I have had discussions about this. Because part of my view about compassion is that compassion is for the dark side, because humans are one of the nastiest, most vicious species that have ever existed on this planet. I mean, if you think about the Romans and the gladiatorial games and the crucifixions and the tortures and the slavery and the way we treated women, it's not a good story, right? And so you have to hold that at the same time as this other idea that our true nature, which is nothing to do with biology, really. It's to do with the consciousness and all that stuff. That is a very different experience of being. But in the biological mind, your experience of biological mind, that's a really tricky. The biological minds are tricky, and they can be very harmful as well as very helpful.
Well, that brings up another point, which is a lot of people don't appreciate that the baggage that they carry from their childhoods or other life experiences oftentimes has a profound effect in terms of every interaction in the future. And whether that's picking a partner, a job, how you interact with others. As I'm sure you're familiar, you see, let's say, women who repeatedly connect with an abusive person. Or, a male who may have been in a situation with his father or mother who repeatedly finds that sort of relationship, which is very detrimental, but they can't seem to help it.
Yeah. Yeah. They have an attachment pattern. And as soon as they see that pattern in another person, it seems to trigger the attachment system and a desire to kind of relate to them. So it's a fascinating phenomena, as you say, that people kind of repeat the cycles of the past, the patterns of the past, and helping people stand back and observe that and become aware of that and work that one through is extremely important, I think.
How you are the creator, the father of, or whatever you wish to term, this idea of compassion-focused therapy, and maybe you could just briefly share sort of how you evolved to create that theory and why, and how it is distinct from more traditional psychological approaches.
Yeah, well, it was a number of things. One is I've always been an evolutionist. And so I wrote a book in the 80s called Human Nature and Suffering, which was looking at motivational systems. Because although we did a lot of work in cognitive therapy, in fact, I was in Edinburgh. And my supervisor did one of the first clinical trials of CBT, and Tim Beck used to come over and train us. So I was very keen on CBT, but I was very also interested in evolution and motivational processes. So that's one part of the story. The other part of the story is I've had a long interest in Buddhism, as you know. And the other part of the story is a clinical story. So we in Edinburgh, we used to, on the MRC unit, we used to take patients from all over. This is in the sort of mid-70s, all over Scotland, and some of them were very poorly, they were almost mute and things like that. Anyhow, so I learned quite a bit while I was there, and so that was my specialty. And then during the 80s, developing therapies for people with chronic depression and sometimes, borderline symptoms and things like this. And we would be doing cognitive therapy, and in cognitive therapy, what you do is you invite people to explore some of the ideas that set in the mind, I'm a failure, I'm no good, my life is pointless, it's useless, all that stuff that sits, I'm inferior, that low rank, I'm a failure, I'm defeated. And then you get them to stand back from that and say, well, if you was, would you talk to a friend like that? And if a friend had the kind of problems you had, how would you support them? And you'd help them kind of become more balanced in their thinking. And And that works quite well for some people, but there are lots of other people that would say, yes, I know that. Like I had one of the core clients that we use in our training. This was a lady who'd been adopted, and the adopted family were quite hostile and aggressive, and she had a difficult time in her adopted family. So she'd always yearned to find her biological mother and to find somebody who would love her, and felt that she wasn't worth loving. But she had a good relationship with her husband. She had three lovely children, and she'd made a number of suicide attempts, which were quite sad, really. But when I spoke to her, she would say, yes, I know I have a husband who loves me, and I can remember the loving things he's done for me, but I feel I don't deserve them, really. And yes, I've got three lovely children, but really, you know, they're lovely because they're lovely. It's not to do with me. So all of that stuff that you get, that kind of thing. So I said, well, but, you know, when you're thinking about that, when you're standing back and you're trying to look at the fact that your husband does care about you and you can remember these caring acts and so forth, how do you actually hear it in your mind? You know, when you're generating these alternative thoughts, how do you hear it in your mind? Can you speak them out as you hear them? Now, I don't know why I asked her that question, because probably I didn't know what else to ask her. So, but anyway, so she said, as I actually hear them in my mind? And I said, yes. She said, okay. Come on, you're doing cognitive therapy. You got a husband who loves you. You know he loves you. You can remember these things that show he loves you. You got three lovely children, haven't you? What's the matter with you? I said, oh, my God. Is that how you hear this stuff? She said, yeah. So the obvious thing to say, I say, well, okay. Well, what about then if we just change the emotional tone of that? You know, we try and produce a kinder tone. And we try and really focus on that, a sense of empathy for the fact that you've struggled with that deep sense of loneliness and lovability for someone. Just connect to that. And she said, absolutely not. I'm not doing that. That's weak. That's pathetic. I'm not doing that. And, you know, she's very kindly came, and this is about 25, 30 years ago, she came on camera and she talks a lot about this. So we show her in our training. So that was the first shock. Firstly, the hostility when people were trying to be helpful to themselves. And I started to ask other depressed people, you know, when you're generating alternative thoughts in the cognitive model, how do you actually hear them? What's the emotional tone? And it was either cold or contemptuous. I'll give you another example. About the same time, this was a lady who was laid in bed and would ruminate, wake up in the morning, think, oh God, I'm depressed again, and so on. So one of the things with CBT is you get them out of bed. You don't, you know, get up, do some yoga exercises, take a cup of tea, whatever it is. And so she wrote a note to put on the side of her bed that when she woke up, she'd see, get out of bed, do your exercises, because to break up, so you're not laying there ruminating about how bad everything is. So she came back the next week and I said, how did it go? She said, it was okay. She said, yes, I got out of bed when I remembered not to lay in bed and ruminate. So I said, okay, so how did it, you know, she said, yes, well, I looked at your note. I woke up and I laid it, looked at your note, and I thought to myself, come on, you lazy fucker, get out of bed. What? Where did that come from? You know, because, you know, so that hostility that was put, constantly being put in whenever people were trying to just be helpful to them. So we had to go after the emotion. We had to go after the motive. So then we discovered that clients didn't want to do it. And the third shock was, which shouldn't have been a shock really, is that every motivational system carries its own trauma. So if you like, you know, going on holidays, you're motivated for new things and exploration, and then one day you get badly beaten up and so on and so on, and sent home, fly home, and have a really bad time. The chances are the next time you get triggered into thinking about holidays, what's going to arise is the trauma. So what we discovered was that if people have abusive or neglectful backgrounds in the care system, the attachment system has got that structure to it. When you start to do compassion work, they don't go, oh, isn't this great? Hand on the heart. I feel so wonderful now. No, no, no. They actually start to feel shit because they're starting to get feelings of being lonely all over again, disconnected. Rage sometimes comes up and they say, I don't understand what's happening to me. You know, trying to be compassionate, what I'm actually feeling is terrible. I don't want to do this, right? And we've got them on camera saying this. So what we discovered was that if your care system, you know, that's the attachment system that is about being cared for and caring, has got trauma in it. These traumas, when you start to try to be compassionate or develop compassion for the self or whatever, actually what you're doing is you're reactivating these unpleasant trauma experiences. You're reactivating memories of what it was like to be in a caring relationship, which obviously wasn't very good. So that meant that we then had to do detoxify in the care. And so a lot of what we do in CFT is to help people begin to experience caring for the first time. So we have to take them through quite often serious grief states. We have to help them learn to tolerate sometimes frightening rage, which they've shut down. And, you know, a lot of our depressed patients hate that. They really do not want to have to face rage, because if you spent your whole life trying to be lovable and do what you can to be loved and wanted, the one thing you don't want to have to visit is what you talked about earlier, Jim, the shadow side. You don't want to have to come to terms with raging. You're ashamed about it. You think it makes you unlovable and a nasty person. One of my clients says, you know, when I started to look at my rage, all I wanted to do was to cut myself and let my darkness out. So compassion-focused therapy is really for all of that stuff, right? It's really for those individuals who are just trapped behind this trauma in the care system and are fighting with themselves to find ways to be lovable or whatever.
What percentage of people sort of in the mental health space of depression or this type of suffering do you think would benefit from CFT versus more traditional CBT, just to get an idea from your own experience?
Yeah, well, it's great question, because you know we call it compassion focused therapy, not compassion therapy, compassion focused. So what it means is that we focus our therapy. So we may do cognitive reevaluation or reappraisal. We help people think about their thoughts. We do mindfulness, all of that sort of stuff. But the key is to check on how they're doing it, the motivation that they're doing it with, because a lot of the people are, it's push, push, push. I've got to do this. I've got to make myself understand this. I've got to, you know, I'm doing mindfulness. Come on, focus, get your mind, you know, all of that stuff. So we make sure that it's a compassion folk, that they get that idea, that they're able to do the breathing exercises that bring on the vagal, that they're able to generate a compassionate motivation before they start these exercises. So we think, obviously, that compassion is a way of focusing and orientating your therapy, whether you're ACT or DBT or whatever it is, and that creates a biological environment and platform, so a lot of the interventions will work better for you. So that's our view, and we've just had a big meta-analysis with nearly 8,000 clients, and the data is very good, actually. So we're very pleased about that. Just published a big meta-analysis on CFT.
The, you know, it's interesting how gaining this insight, though, is so hard for so many people because, as you mentioned, they're in these sort of fixed patterns of how they see the world. And it's, I think, you know, very difficult to, you know, change those patterns. It's interesting. Obviously see a lot of people coming to emergency rooms with head trauma and other things, but it's sort of fascinating because non-English or non-English as first language people, whenever they're traumatized, they revert back to their primary language. And yeah. It's interesting. I think this is also true of people who by appearance have overcome trauma, but when they are forced or in a situation where they're traumatized again, all of these feelings that they've been repressing suddenly come out.
Yes. Yes, that's so right. So these are sort of memories and patterns, because basically they're patterns that are stored within the threat system. And then when you know, it's like if, you know, you eat cheesecakes and one day you get violently sick from a cheesecake, you're fine as long as you don't encounter cheesecakes, and then you smell a cheesecake and you suddenly get nausea again. So those, you know, and it's, you know, Vessel's van der Kolk stuff, you know, the body keeps the score. So you're absolutely right about that. You know, these memories can be stored in the body, and they seem to go dormant until they get a trigger, and then there they go again, you know.
Well, you know, this reminds me of two things. One is, this idea of this, and it's attributed to Viktor Frankl, although he never said it actually, but this situation of emotion regulation before between stimulus and response, there's a pause, and I'm paraphrasing this, but within that pause lies your freedom. And it's how do you self-regulate, I think. The other aspect is what people don't understand, I think, is that it's their choice to attach emotion to a memory, because memories don't have valence. We give them that valence. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, emotions tend to be laid down in context, and those contexts tend to be linked to memory, don't they? I mean, that's what's conditioned, is the emotional, the physiological patterns of that emotion. So, you know, if somebody breaks in right now and puts a gun to your head, right? That will cause you an alarm. So the next time you hear the name Paul Gilbert, you might go, oh, my God.
That's already happened during this interview.
So, yeah, I mean, emotions are laid down, because what's triggered by an event is the emotion. If there's no emotion triggered, then obviously you're not going to remember it. So, you know, emotions are often part of memories. What you're suggesting, however, is that when we work to be able to overcome those memories, then we work by slightly separating the emotion from the memory. That's what you do when you're de-traumatizing people, so they can begin to have the thought or the image or the flashback or whatever it is. We're not being overly powered by the body memory experiences that were laid down when they first experienced that event.
You know, it's interesting, you made a comment earlier how you had your own issues with depression, and you said, and maybe I'm getting it correct, maybe you can clarify it. It was something, well, I knew that wasn't me, or my mind was here and this event was happening. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that, about this sort of, I don't know if the word's a bifurcation or dichotomy between these two things that are happening?
Yeah, it's a very interesting, question, that, because I always had a reasonable sense of myself, in a sense. I've always been a sort of happy-go-lucky person, even in the course of violence. And I've also been somebody who likes friendships. And I think that partly comes from my early life, because I had some very good friendships when I was in Africa as well, and in the American Missionary School. In fact, I met up with a person that I hadn't seen for many years, who's now in Australia, actually. So friendships were always very, very important to me. And so even though I was had these experiences that were happening, a number of, because I'd had a lot of difficult life events had all come one on top of the other, which is sort of slightly overwhelming, really. There was a sense in which something has happened to me, but I'm still me. I still have the same desire to be friendly. I still have the same ideas about what I want out of life. I still have the same interest in music and that sort of thing, interests in music. So, and mine was primarily an anxious-based depression. I used to get terrible panics. I used to send my wife into the shop, and I'd sit in the car trembling like a, oh my God, I can't go in. So mine was like that. And it took about 6 months, I suppose, maybe a little longer, and then it gradually subsided. But I was always very fascinated by it, and as well as being, you know, my wife was fantastic, actually, because she said to me, look, the reason you're feeling what you're feeling is because you've been through some terrible things. You've been, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so you don't worry about it. You know, I can do the shopping. You sit in the car and tremble. It's fine. You know? So she was completely de-shaming and completely accepting and completely saying, look, you know, your body's screwed for a bit because you're just overwhelmed with all this stuff. Don't worry. And I think those sorts of experiences were terrific and allowed me to just be it with whatever was going on without fighting it or shaming myself for it or whatever, just recognizing. And also, as a researcher, I was thinking, this is very interesting. You know, I'm waking up in the morning and I'm having thoughts that I'd rather kill myself at the moment, but I don't think I'm going to do that. But that's really interesting. So I had that sort of slightly detached experience. I don't know why, but that's how it was. You know?
Well, but I think, you know, one thing that you point out to what you're saying is that having someone who unconditionally loves you and who is there for you and supportive is hugely, hugely important.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing about it was she never panicked. You know, she didn't, she just said it's understandable, it's natural, you get over it, just give it time, basically.
Wow, maybe she should have been a psychologist.
Yes.
Or she was, I guess.
Yes, yes, yes.
No, actually, another question for you. So I think many of the things that you're saying are incredibly important. And maybe you can just comment on this. I'm sure you know Robert Waldinger, who ran the Harvard study for now it's been going on for 85 years, although obviously he's much younger than that. He took it over. But we were having this conversation about the importance of relationships and depth of relationships and friendships and how, you know, if you look at so much work, it'll talk about, well, you have to exercise, you know, you have to eat what many people describe as the Mediterranean diet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But by far and away, the most important thing is human connection.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and you know all the physiological reasons for that, you know, to do with how it affects immune systems, the vagal nerve, the frontal cortex, all that stuff. So, you know, connections are not these just pleasant things. They are actually physiologically extremely powerful. You know, we're physiologically regulated through our connections.
So how do you think mindfulness intersects with this?
Well, there's lots of, you know, there's a whole load of controversies about mindfulness. There's, you know, mindfulness, which is really about paying attention to your mind and that sort of stuff. And then there's, on the other side, there are the Buddhists who say mindfulness is a way of liberating yourself from being trapped in the dictates of a biological brain that wants you to think about yourself and to survive and strive, right? So you got caught up in a biological brain that's, you know, wants you to survive and strive. And a sense of yourself, you're the most important thing that exists, which your DNA would like you to do. That's what it's programmed you to do. So mindfulness helps you begin to see the illusions and that you're now, if you get caught up in that brain, then you lose contact with the concept of the transpersonal self, you know, that self that's actually beyond, was not, you know, I mean, Matthew Ricard, as you know, says, you know, your mind is like, well, like water, it can contain a poison or a medicine, but water is pure. And the problem with consciousness is it's sort of pure in a way. So you get all these textures in consciousness. So mindfulness allows you to begin to settle that biological mind, the chatter of that biological mind, the drives of that biological mind, the identifications of that biological mind, so that you can begin to touch this notion of the ground of all being, of interconnectedness. And that's a very different deal from the way we use mindfulness in therapy. So in therapy, we're not teaching people how to have non-duality experiences. We're not doing that's something for the, you know, the people who know how to do that. What we're doing is helping people just observe the mind, observe the flow of feeling, the motives, and whether they want to go with them or they don't want to go with them. So we're using mindfulness is in a very different way than liberation of letting go and the illusions of the self and all of that. So mindfulness can be used, and I think probably we need different terms to describe these things. I think part of the problem is we're using a term called mindfulness, which actually covers quite different experiences, different practices, different, you know, there's a, the Buddhist traditions are hugely important for the ethical and moral elements of mindfulness. I mean, that's important in compassion too. But so mindfulness, when it's about the liberation of the self, the seeing through the illusions of a biological mind that's made you want to strive, survive and strive, is different from the way we use mindfulness as a therapy, which helps you deal, become aware of and deal with some of the chaos of your biological mind.
I think you're exactly right. And obviously, I think one is more oriented towards Buddhist philosophy and nature, while the other is a practical technique that allows Westerners to view their mind and not get attached to events or emotional states that distract them.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Couple other questions. One is, do you have any opinions on free will?
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, you probably got a fantastic guy in your part of the world called Robert Sobolsky.
It's funny you say that. You can listen to that podcast.
Well, he's just written an amazing book called Determined. And of course, according to Robert Sobolsky, no, there is no such thing as free will. So, the way he builds the argument, I think, is very, very pervasive. But I'm not quite sure, you may be able to answer this, is that what happens at the point at which consciousness becomes aware of itself, right? So we have many animals are conscious. Clearly they're conscious. They are conscious of things, but they don't have a consciousness of being conscious. So they don't have this knowing intentionality that can reflect back on itself. As far as we know, chimpanzees don't sit under trees worrying about what they're going to do tomorrow and what's the meaning of life and so on and so on, as far as we know. So this consciousness of consciousness, I'm not quite sure how that fits with Sapolsky's ideas. I'm sure he would explain it in fascinating ways, but humans are not just like other animals because we have these faculties. But he may have a way of saying, yeah, but it doesn't matter because what comes into consciousness is still determined by, you know, each moment is determined by the previous moment is basically his story.
And your biology, he would say. Yes. So he and I had actually quite an interesting conversation on the new book. So you might be interested in that, as maybe our listeners.
Yeah,
but that was a funny conversation. But along those lines, I think you point out something, which is you said, well, animals don't really have that. But I wonder, because as we learn more, as an example, we suddenly realize, as an example, and elephants have memories and they have sadness, there are animals that clearly demonstrate anxiety and fear, and perhaps from their own patterns of attachment. And then you see the soothing behaviors of animals, and even crows are quite intelligent. So is it possible that, in fact, there is some self-reflection? You know, this was, I think the study was done with crows. What's the idea? Theory of mind.
No, absolutely right. And I mean, you know, there are primates who clearly have self-awareness. You know, if you put a spot on their nose, they know that this, and you give them a mirror recognition and all that stuff. Yes, absolutely. But, you know, for example, do they know what they're actually doing and why they're doing it? So we often say, you know, a lion clearly intends to hunt and kill prey, but does it do it knowingly? Can it make a decision? All this hunting, you know, is a bit barbaric, don't you think? I think I'll become a vegetarian, you know. I'll be one of the first vegetarian lions. I'm going to start a movement, how to be a vegetarian predator. I think that could catch on, you know what I mean? They can't do that sort of thinking as far as we know. I mean, maybe. Yeah. You know, they can't decide, oh, I better get fit because I'm not as fast as I used to be and I'm not catching the prey that I used to be. I better go circuit training. There is something about an awareness of being, a reflective consciousness, a consciousness of being conscious, an awareness of being aware, which I think, I might be wrong about that, is different from simply awareness and consciousness. But I might be wrong about that.
I think to be determined, as we know, if we had this conversation 20 or 30 years ago, it's like even this idea of neuroplasticity, you'd say, oh, that's ridiculous. So I think as we learn more, we gain more and more insights. So the next topic, what are your thoughts on psychedelics?
Yeah, fascinating. We're doing a study, as you know, in Argentina. I think psychedelics are really, really interesting. What does it all mean? I mean, because, you know, the point about it is we the brain changes when you take psychedelics. It becomes much more integrative and so on and so on. And then people can have these extraordinary experiences. What's very interesting, as you know, a lot depends on the context in which they experience, you know, psilocybin. For example, if they feel safe and secure with the people that they're doing it with, they're more likely to have trips of interconnectedness and union with all things, whereas if they feel unsafe, so they go into the experience with a sense of a lack of safeness or distrust in the people that are doing it, they're more likely to have rather less pleasant. So that means that the substance itself and the way the brain is working is very dependent upon context. Right? Context is very important for the experiences that people are having. What does it all mean? I'm not sure. It's an open question, really. But it's very clear that the brain, when you give it certain kinds of chemicals, you change the physiology of the brain, will give you experiences of extraordinary forms of interconnectedness and the not loss of the self, but more of an expansion of the self. Dan Siegel talks not so much about self-transcendent, but an expansion. So you become, you know, a one with all things, as it were. So that's really interesting. It's the same with, you know, all the work that's going on in near-death experiences now. I mean, what does it actually all mean? I don't know. I just think it's all very interesting.
Well, yeah, me too. Actually, Dan Siegel was another guest of mine. So anybody listening to the podcast, check out that. But just to make two comments on what you said, one is I have not really had any desire to take psychedelics. It's a somewhat long story because my wife is very inquisitive, but she's also very anxious. So she had two friends who offered her the opportunity, one to do an iboga experience and the other to do the toad or this Bufo alveolus. But anyway.
That's esoteric. That's quite esoteric, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, but my wife signed up for both of these.
Oh, right.
And you know, these are not inexpensive. So she was telling me about this, and I said, really, you're going to do this? Well, that's fantastic. I'm really interested in hearing what's going to happen. And so as the time draws near, she comes, she goes, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. She goes, why don't you do it? And then tell me about it, and I'll decide if I'm going to do it. So I ended up doing both of those. And so I did the iboga experience. But I think it very much aligns with what you were just saying. Because one, I think the challenge for many people is they haven't faced their shadow.
Yeah.
And if you haven't done that, that will show its ugly head and can be extraordinarily terrifying. And I think, as you also said, this idea of anxiety and fear has a huge, huge determinant. So, you know, I did both of these experiences. And you know, people are crying, weeping, some are vomiting it with the iboga. And, you know, for me, it was just this glorious, pleasant experience. And it was actually perfectly fine. And then I did the toad, which, again, as you probably know, really only lasts about 15 or 20 minutes. But, you know, for me, it was going out into the universe and the sense of oneness and this joy of interconnectedness and love, where I just wept for 20 minutes, and it was like just this beautiful experience. And so, but even after I told my wife, they said, I can't do it. I'm too afraid to do it. So, there you have it. In terms of the near-death experience, as you know, I was in the serious car accident many years ago, and which I will admit was based on stupidity and the use of alcohol and drugs. So I, you know, have to accept that truth. But regardless, we ended up hitting a tree and I ended up having abdominal trauma and a transected small bowel, fractured spine, fractured spleen. But during that experience, I actually had a near death event, which is sort of the classic thing where you are going down a river, if you will, of light, and you're heading towards this brilliant light at the end, and you have these voices sort of telling you they want you with them, et cetera, et cetera. And it was interesting because just as I was about to enter the light, which of course symbolized death, I suddenly said no. And the next thing I know, I wake up in the ICU. And it's funny because so many people attribute sort of why I'm connected to compassion or promoting goodness or whatever did that experience. No, it had zero impact on anything. To me, it was hypoxia resulted in this massive release of and gamma oscillation in your occipital cortex, and it had no impact whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, it is. There's this channel called Heaven Awaits. I think that's what the channel's called. And you can listen to all these people's. And there's a guy called Grayson who's fascinating. He's done a lot of research on it. But they're quite, I mean, there are similarities, but there are also some very different ones where people see devils and demons and Christ telling them that, you know, if they don't repent and all that. Whereas other people, and then they have the life reviews, and you think, well, hang on a minute, why don't you go read Sapolsky? Because there's no point in having a life review. It was all determined anyway, you know. So I just don't know what it all means. I mean, it means that the brain is extraordinary in how it creates experiences and the dimensions of experiences it creates. You know, one would like to think that, that maybe all of these states are possible. I just don't know. I love Donald Hoffman. Do you know Donald Hoffman's stuff?
No.
Oh, The Case Against Reality. I'll send you some of his. Donald Hoffman is amazing. He's another guy in your neck of the woods. He's a...
Really?
Yeah, he's a physicist and mathematician who shows that the time and space dimensions don't actually exist. Anyway, now I'll send you that because a lot of it goes over my head, really. But it's fascinating stuff. Yeah, what the new physics are telling us about the nature of the physical world, if you can understand it.
Well, actually, it's funny you bring that up because I'm still trying to fucking understand consciousness. You know, it's like every week there is a new theory by typically incredibly brilliant people based on nothing other than their belief of something. Yeah. And you know, it's funny because of course oftentimes there's this criticism against faith traditions, but to me consciousness is a leap of faith in the sense that no one knows. And this debate has been going on between philosophers, scientists, et cetera, for millennia. And we're not even any closer. I don't know if you saw this conversation between Chalmers and Christopher Koch. And one's a philosopher and one's a neuroscientist. And Christopher Koch had said, well, we'll have knowledge about consciousness within 25 years, and we'll have solved that problem. And the bet was, I guess, for a case of wine, and Christopher Koch delivered his case of wine. there you have it. So I don't understand it. And in fact, it's so funny because it's like every week there's a new theory, and I was at something by what's his name, the physicist Penrose and Hameroff, the anesthesiologist. You know, getting back to this idea of consciousness is contained somehow with the quantum effect within the microtubules of the brain. So I don't know.
The collapse of the wave.
Yes, the collapse of the wave. And then, you know, it's, I don't know if you're aware, but, you know, Deepak Chopra, I was with him in Dubai in 2018, and he was saying, Jim, you know, I'm retiring, but I'm only going to focus on consciousness. And that's what he's focused on, but I'm not sure if he's any closer that he was in 2018. So,
I
love the fact that you say, I just don't know, because, you know, there's so much we do know. But I think what we see, even through our own conversation, the reality of how much we don't know. And I think that's, in some ways, sort of what curiosity does. And it creates this sense of awe. And I think in some ways, joy as well, about sort of being in this world and living this experience and trying to sort of process it all as sort of individuals who maybe God has not imbued us with the tool set to understand whatever God is. On that note, Paul, what would you like to leave with our listeners today to positively change their lives? Or maybe, if you don't want to do that, conversely, but I think you probably would want to do that.
Well, I think, no, it's great, isn't it? I mean, one of the things people often say, what drives you to for compassion? Then basically it's anger. It's anger that life is so full of suffering for so many people. And, you know, we all come here and we live for a little bit and then we gradually decay and suffer all kinds of pains and diseases and losses. Everybody will at some point experience a loss for which they would grieve terribly and so on and so on. And so, you know, I think the point about it is that we don't understand the link between consciousness, which is supposed to be the ground of all being, or the energy flows that actually give rise to some atomic particles, that give rise to patterns of trees, molecules, or don't understand this. But what we do know is that I suspect, I don't know, but actually all of this biological stuff is just an outpouring of these physical laws of the universe, right? And then in a way, consciousness flows through them. So we then, once we become aware of that, we become the servants of consciousness, because biological minds are basically full of shit. So we are responsible for, if consciousness is going to flow through biology as it does, we have to find ways in which we can serve consciousness so that we can move biological minds towards a more compassionate way of living. I mean, if you look at the last, I don't know, 10, 20 million years, you know, life is pretty savage, really. It's eat or be eaten and die of viruses and bacteria. So there's something about biological minds, the biology of the universe, which is not terribly pleasant. So we have to come to terms with that. And I really don't have much truck with people who say, oh, life is so wonderful, isn't it great? Well, it is if you're healthy and you're loved and you want it, but it isn't if you're in terrible pain. If you're in Gaza, life's not so good, is it really? So, you know, we have to understand that compassion is really our gift to consciousness. It's our awareness that actually this is a world of great suffering, and therefore we have to take responsibility to do what we can to prevent it. Now, that has any long-term effect, I have no idea. But that's how I see it, really. That's my view.
Well, no, and I agree with you. I mean, you can take the view in terms of, you know, Sapolsky's perception that there's no free will or that reality. You say, well, then what's the purpose? But I think as a biological being, our purpose is to try in the best way possible to alleviate the suffering of all beings.
Yeah, that's right.
And that is actually the gift of being alive. And in some ways, that is the gift of consciousness to us, and to have it flow through us. And that, I think, is the highest level of consciousness.
Yes. I mean, exactly, Jim. You and I are absolutely on this. It's our responsibility. Once you become conscious of conscious, you have that, then it's actually how you then use that awareness to say, okay, right, so all of biological life that has no choice. It has to do what it's designed to do. Dinosaurs do dinosaur things. You know, great whites do great white things. But humans don't. And we can actually start to think about, actually, we don't have to obey the dictates of a biological mind out of control. And that's a fantastic, new in evolution. There's never, as far as we know, there's never been a species that could do that, but we can. At the moment, we're using our intelligence to do horrible things, but we can use it to do fantastic things as well. And I think therefore we are servants to compassion. We serve the motives of compassion. We serve the consciousness to try to create a world where people can be conscious of joy and happiness, not misery and suffering.
No, and I think that sort of comes to something I frequently say is that, you know, so many people will sit there and say, well, I have no agency, I can't change anything. But I always say each and every one of us, regardless of our position in this world, have the ability to improve the life of at least one person every day.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Paul, thank you for being with me today. As usual, a very entertaining conversation. I hope we're able to share a pint one of these days in the distant future. Maybe if we can give you enough pints, we can have you play the guitar for us.
Yes, I'd be too drunk to play by then. So. No, and also thank you, Jim, because you know what you've done with Seacare and the podcast and your drive and your it's just been terrific. I mean, you've been a real light to the world, so it's been great, and you're great. You know, it's great fun. I don't think we take ourselves too seriously. We're here for a short bit of time, then we decay and piss off somewhere. That's it, really. Do what we can while we're here.
Yes, I'm gonna try avoiding, at least for the moment, pissing off. But thanks again, Paula. You know, it's always a joy, and I appreciate your time.
Okay.
Take care. Again, thank you for being with us today. The Into the Magic Shop podcast can be found where you find your most popular podcasts, or you can find us at intothemagicshop.com.